Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Vox Talk for the week of Tuesday the 15th of July. My name is Ross and I'm compiling this week's edition. This week's news items were collected from the local Oxford papers, with news being selected and read by Rosemary Shergold and Patricia Lee. Sunrise for the upcoming week will be around 5 a.m, with sunset being around 9 p.m. The copying and distribution of the USBs is by Michelle Lawful. Here, there will be some instructions on how to listen to Vox Talk using your Alexa device, and at the end of this edition, you will hear how to access Vox Talk online. After which, we have an announcement regarding electric blanket testing.
Notice to listeners of Vox Talk who use a smart speaker to access our service. There are new instructions for anyone who listens to Vox Talk using Alexa. To listen to Vox Talk in this way, you now have to use the Talking Newspaper skill. First, you need to enable it. Simply say, Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper. Then, to listen to Vox Talk, please follow this procedure.
Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have problems listening to Vox Talk in this way, it could be due to the way that your Alexa device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set up your device in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact Vox Talk and we will try to help.
This is an electric blanket testing announcement, compiled by Trading Standards and read by David Brasington. When you have listened to the announcement, if you have an electric blanket, you can ring up the nearest centre to you to arrange for your electric blanket to be tested, or ask your carer or member of your family to arrange this. It is important your electric blanket is tested each year.
How safe is your electric blanket? Trading Standards, working with district councils, the Fire and Rescue Service, Age UK and the Volunteer Driver Service, are offering free electric blanket checks. So make sure your electric blanket is safe to use this winter. The dates and venues of the checks in September are Monday the 22nd in Rose Hill, Oxford, Tuesday the 23rd in Henley-on-Thames, Wednesday the 24th in Bicester, Thursday the 25th in Chipping Norton, and Friday the 26th in Abingdon. In October, the venues and dates are Monday the 6th in Risinghurst, Oxford, Tuesday the 7th in Didcot, Wednesday the 8th in Banbury, Thursday the 9th in Whitney, and Friday the 10th in Wantage. So why not join us and bring a friend for free refreshments and information about keeping safe and well? We're offering collections from your home if you're unable to get to us, so please tell us when you make your booking that you need a collection. To book your safety check appointment, call 01865 519 800 and select option 4, or email duty.officer@oxfordshire.gov.uk. You can also book online by going to service.oxfordshire.gov.uk/blanket testing. Appointments are on a first-come, first-served basis, so book early.
The government wants a controversial immigration centre near Oxford to be reopened by December. Campsfield House in Kidlington has had many issues, including riots, escapes and complaints about conditions, before it closed in 2018. Home Secretary Yvette Cooper announced last year that the government were pushing ahead with plans to reopen the centre, which was condemned by activists and local politicians. Facilities management company Mighty was awarded the 6-year contract to run the centre, with an option to extend this for another 2 years. Mighty ran the centre before it closed, and also runs a number of immigration removal centres, including in Dungavel and Heathrow. Bill McKeith, a member of Keep Campsfield Closed Coalition, said, "Mighty does not have a good record. Its time running Campsfield was marred by a major fire, suicide and 3 mass hunger strikes. Just a year ago, the Chief Inspector of Prisons reported that the Mighty-run Harmonsworth Detention Centre near Heathrow, where inspectors found the worst conditions they have seen in immigration detention. It is shocking that the company responsible for that has been awarded this contract." A Mighty spokesperson said, "Mighty's new contract to operate Campsfield Immigration Retention Centre is the result of our commitment to uphold the highest standards of welfare, safety and dignity for all residents in our care." HM Inspectorate of Prisons' most recent report on Harmonsworth, following a review of progress, recognised the centre's exceptional response, highlighting a respectful and positive culture between colleagues and residents, as well as a significant improvement to living conditions and facilities since the previous inspection. "We are proud to be bringing the same dedication, compassion and strong leadership to the running of Campsfield IRC, ensuring a safe and supportive environment for all." Green councillor Ian Middleton said he heard that the contract had been awarded and received an email letter from the Deputy Director, Immigration Enforcement, Will Round. The letter stated that the government's ambition was to have the centre reopened by December. Mr Middleton said he could not confirm how realistic this timescale is, and said the refurbishment and redevelopment of the building had been somewhat shrouded in secrecy, even from local councillors. He added that "this is the same company who ran Campsfield immediately before its closure doesn't bode well for future detainees, and adds further to the perception that the Labour government is making the same mistakes as their predecessors." In June, the Home Office said it would refurbish the existing buildings, which would accommodate 160 people, and then expand the buildings for the centre to house a total of 400 people. Mighty says Campsfield House will be the first all-electric immigration removal centre, powered solely by renewable energy solar panels and heat pumps, which Mr Middleton called tone deaf. He said, "I'm sure these desperate people being held without trial in Campsfield will find cold comfort in claims that power for the systems denying them their liberty is sustainably sourced."
The County Council has been accused of risking thousands of livelihoods in Oxford by experimenting with its plans for a congestion charge. Oxfordshire County Council has proposed charging motorists £5 a day to drive into the city centre along most routes. It aims to ease congestion in the short term before the traffic filters are introduced when Botley Road reopens. The roads affected include Hythe Bridge Street, St Cross Road, Thames Street and St Clement Street every day from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m, as well as Marston Ferry Road and Hollow Way, Monday to Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. The plans have divided opinion, with a petition against the scheme surpassing 11,000 signatures, while others, including locals, bus companies and active travel groups, have backed the plans. A total of 17 written questions were sent to Councillor Andrew Gant, Cabinet Member for Transport Management, about the congestion charge in advance of the full meeting which was held on Tuesday, July the 8th. Bernadette Evans from Oxford Business Action Group wrote to ask whether the charge could be put in place immediately before the Christmas trading period. Mr. Gant said he could not give a specific date for when the scheme would be implemented, other than in the autumn, but argued that the congestion charge would boost the city's attractiveness for 90% of city centre visitors who come by park and ride, rail, bus, on foot or by bike, which would in turn support businesses. Outside the meeting, she added, inexplicably, Councillor Gant and his supporters say that the congestion charge isn't going to negatively impact Oxford's small businesses at all. Unfortunately, he hasn't taken the time to speak to any Oxford business owners to ask their views on this, which is a shame, as so many of us would welcome the opportunity. Businesses such as those in Holloway and the Charwell Drive Parade, which are situated immediately adjacent to the digital tolls, will likely lose customers who discover it's been made harder to get there by car. The council is casually experimenting on Oxford small business owners during a cost of living crisis and risking thousands of livelihoods in the process. Councillors also grilled cabinet members on the measures later in the meeting. Independent councillor Saj Malik asked why Oxford was getting congestion charge, arguing that other towns like Abingdon had similar traffic levels and why East Oxford rather than North Oxford was seeing the brunt of these measures. Mr. Gant said the locations of the traffic filters, where the congestion charging points are, were chosen many years ago and were about managing transport in the city as a whole, and this affects people in North Oxford as much as anywhere else. His written response also said that Oxford is more congested than other parts of the county and that only Abingdon is similar, that 173,000 cars enter or leave Oxford each day, almost twice as many as Banbury, and that Oxford has narrower streets and higher levels of walking and cycling. When Mr. Malik asked whether the consultation would be listened to, Mr. Gant said he would read the responses with enormous care, but he would not just add up the ticks in one column and the crosses in the other. Many also raised questions about the County Council's traffic modelling methods for the roads that would be affected by the charge. Mr. Gant said at the meeting, as many of these responses make clear, all transport modelling is subject to uncertainty. It is designed to give a picture of overall change, and it is less useful for looking at individual specific locations. He added, this is a very important proposal with very important benefits, but it will not absolutely solve everything in Oxford and Oxfordshire, and it must be seen in the context of a wider suite of proposals.
A level crossing has been closed following a series of dangerous incidents involving people taking selfies with their mobile phones. Shocking images show people putting themselves, passengers and railway staff in danger as they stop to take selfies on the high-speed railway line. Wantage Road pedestrian level crossing in Grove near Wantage has been closed for Network Rail and local authorities to work on implementing a permanent solution following a spate of dangerous incidents. Images taken last month at the crossing on the Great Western Main Line, on which trains can travel at speeds of up to 125 miles an hour, show people stopping on the tracks to take photos. In July 2022, Network Rail released CCTV footage showing a group of children dancing and performing scooter tricks on the active railway line at the same crossing. accidental deaths on the rail network have risen by 26% compared to last year, prompting Network Rail and British Transport Police to launch a new campaign targeting unsafe behaviour on the railway. Emma Barry, level crossing manager for Network Rail, said, "These images show actions we see far too often across the rail network, of people acting in a reckless and incredibly dangerous manner at level crossings. The number of unsafe incidents at this particular crossing has left us with no choice but to take action and close it before a tragedy happened. The people in those photos not only put themselves at serious risk of death with their unsafe behaviour, they also put the safety of our staff and passengers at risk. Our new safety campaign with the British Transport Police is deliberately hard-hitting at a time where accidental deaths on the railway are at a five-year high. We're urging everyone to follow guidance on using level crossings safely and stay alert when using them, particularly with the school summer holidays approaching." New safety films will be seen across Britain this summer as Network Rail and the British Transport Police launch a campaign to tackle rising unsafe behaviour around the rail network. A total of 24 people lost their lives in preventable accidents on the railway last year. Five of those lives were lost at level crossings, while the other 19 were a result of crossing the railway at unauthorised locations. Working with the emergency services and film industry professions, two new safety films have been made that show the real consequences of unsafe behaviour through the experiences of those who witness the aftermath. One explores the emotional impact on families when loved ones have been badly injured on the railway, while the second features an NHS trauma specialist explaining the catastrophic injuries caused by getting hit by a train.
An Oxford band brought cheer to a painful 9-hour Eurostar disruption by playing a surprise gig. Indie folk band Stornoway were travelling on the 7:52 a.m. train from Brussels to London on Sunday, July the 6th. When it came to a stop about 2 hours into the journey, somewhere outside Guine, France. Despite passengers frequently being told a replacement train would be arriving soon, the breakdown lasted for about 9 hours and tensions soon rose. Ollie Steadman, a multi-instrumentalist in the band, told us there was a wall of silence from staff about what was happening. There were six-month-old babies and lots of frail people, he said. Someone was actually taken away in a stretcher, and it looked like maybe they were old and frail and hadn't been given fluids. So for those folks who were in much more need than us, it was just really painful to watch. Mr. Steadman said when the doors did eventually open after 3 hours of being locked inside, the first thing that greeted the passengers was a wall of birdsong. "We broke down in the right place," he said. Actually hearing the birdsong then inspired us to come out with our songs and play for everyone. And remember that one of the great things about music is it's such a comforter. And so the band picked up their instruments and played a set list that included "The Only Way Is Up" by Yaz, opening with the new lyrics, "We've been broken down for 6 hours long, being on the Eurostar sure ain't no fun." Mr. Steadman said the passengers are immediately really happy and grateful to hear the music. One passenger, Gabriella Saturin, happened to also be a tambourine player, and he joined the band without any playing or rehearsal, which Mr. Steadman said was really magical. After we'd finished the music, time sort of sped up a bit, because time flies when you're having a bit more fun, said Mr. Steadman. It had seemed just endless before, because we had been really just starving of oxygen before they'd opened the doors. And the toilets weren't working because the toilets depended on the electricity that wasn't coming from the engine. After the music, it was a bit of a different picture because the music cheered everyone up. Eurostar said the train arrived into London at 7:20 p.m. But by this point, many passengers had missed their plans. DJ Kaneen was one of them and missed a huge London show as a result of the disruption. A spokesperson for Eurostar said the situation was extremely difficult for our travellers.
Work on a £10.3 million contentious bridge is expected to start in November and see the River Thames closed. Oxford City Council will follow Environment Agency advice and carry out construction work for Oxpens Bridge during the winter. The bridge will link Oxpens Meadow to Grandpont Nature Park and was given planning permission in April last year. But challenges from resident groups saw the verdict go to the High Court, which also dismissed their argument. And then on June the 17th, the Transport Secretary confirmed in a public letter the council is now allowed to construct the bridge over the River Thames. Objectors had raised concerns about navigational issues, particularly around the need for the river to be closed. A letter from the Department for Transport's Tim Brimelow confirmed the main bridge sections will be built off-site and craned into place. Based on advice from the Environmental Agency, the bridge can only be fitted between the 1st and the 15th of November, a space of 2 weeks. However, the City Council believes that because the bridge is mostly going to be built away from the Thames, it will require a 3-day closure. Thereafter, there will be a short period, approximately 2 weeks, while the bridge sections are secured, Mr. Brimelow said. The Council have confirmed that they are proposing to liaise closely with the Environment Agency in relation to the construction of the bridge, and to seek to minimise disruption as much as possible. He added, the effect on navigation, both during construction and after, due to the proximity of other bridges, has been raised. While not being aware of any particular study with regard to the proximity of other bridges, the Secretary of State is satisfied that any effect of close proximity of the existing bridges would have been considered by the relevant navigational authorities in the statutory consultation on the scheme, and no objections by those authorities have been raised. Winter was chosen as the time to carry out the work because it is the time when the river traffic is at its lowest, the Department for Transport said. It was important to clarify that the bridge, once constructed, has a soffit level over the river, agreed with the Environment Agency, the department added. It will not block any craft that can access this stretch of the river currently and is clear of any flood impact. As such, the scheme will not impact on navigation of the river once built.
Thames Water has warned of a hosepipe ban being imposed as it struggles to keep up with customer demand. The troubled company said water supplies across Oxfordshire and the rest of its area are being impacted because of hot weather. It said in Oxfordshire, residents' daily demand for water is similar to that of the 2022 drought. Thames Water spokeswoman said, the ongoing dry weather and increased customer demand is impacting our water supplies across the Thames Valley. And unless the situation changes significantly, we will need to put usage restrictions, including a hosepipe ban, in place to ensure taps keep running for customers' essential use. The UK has had one of the warmest and driest springs in over a century, and the continued hot weather now means that the Environment Agency has placed the Thames area into the prolonged dry water category, meaning there is heightened concern and risk of drought. Every drop of water we use comes from the environment, and we're asking our customers to help us by reducing their water use wherever possible. On Monday, June the 30th, in the Swindon and the Oxfordshire areas, our customers' daily demand for water reached that last seen during the 2022 drought. It is important to stay hydrated, but there are many ways customers can save water during the summer. Some of our top tips include taking shorter showers, turning the tap off while brushing teeth, and letting your lawn go dry. This can help reduce big increases in demand and also help the environment, which is currently water-stressed. We continue to monitor our water resources carefully, and the extended warm weather also brings increased risks of leaks and bursts due to pipe stress and shifting foundations in the ground. We are working to ensure that our leakage engineers are placed where leaks are most likely to occur, and our teams are working day and night to find and fix leaks using innovative technology. Last month, the Environment Agency said England faces public water shortages of 5 billion litres a day by 2055 without urgent action to cut leaks, curb use, and build new reservoirs. The Environment Agency, EA, also warned that the wider economy faces a further deficit of 1 billion litres a day, with growing demand from the energy sector, food production, and businesses such as water-intensive data centres. The highly populated southeast region of England faces the biggest shortfall, with an estimated extra 2 billion litres of water a day needed between 2030 and 2055. Some 60% of the shortfall needs to come from water companies managing demand for water from households and businesses and halving the amount of water lost to leaks, the EA warned.
Broadcaster Geraldine Peers has been announced as the host for the Oxford Climate Awards. The awards, run by the Oxford Mail in partnership with Oxford City Council, aim to celebrate individuals and groups who make a significant impact in their community by championing environmental sustainability. Now it has been announced that Ms. Peers will host the awards ceremony in a black tie event on September the 17th at Oxford Town Hall, honouring the efforts of the nominees. The host has spoken about the effect of climate change and how seeing a blackberry in July was an unusual sign for her of abnormal temperatures. "I was very surprised to see a ripe blackberry down by the marina in Abingdon," said Miss Pierce. "When I was a child, my family would pick blackberries in Cornwall, and I'm sure that was at the end of August. I don't think I've seen a blackberry looking like this so early in the year. I'm maintaining this is the first blackberry in Abingdon this year. I think the recent heat wave with temperatures well into the 30s does really make it look like the world is overheating, and we should be doing all we can to combat that." The Climate Awards are a good way of making people aware of these issues and what they can do to make a difference. Miss Pierce, who lives in Oxfordshire, has worked in TV and radio since she was at school. She presented the regional TV news for Oxfordshire for 3 decades. For ITV at Central News in Abingdon, and then the BBC at South Today in Oxford. Her love of broadcasting started in radio in the 1980s, when she worked on Timmy Mallett's radio show in Manchester in the evenings after school, writing sketches and jingles. She has presented radio shows on Radio Oxford and Radio Wiltshire. "Looking forward to hosting the Oxford Climate Award," she added. "I love hearing stories about how people have made a difference to their communities. It's great that the Oxford Mail and the City Council want to recognise those individuals and organisations, and hopefully the awards will inspire other people, groups and businesses to make changes that will help the environment. The awards aim to honour exemplary efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, protect natural ecosystems and promote sustainable practices. Last year, Rose Hill and Iffley Low Carbon was judged to be the best of the best at the awards evening held at the Town Hall.
A children's hospice has raised £44,000 in just 2 weeks to fund repairs to its roof ahead of the winter. Helen and Douglas House, located in Oxford, launched the appeal after it discovered sections of its roof needed urgent repairs to protect them from heavy rain and further weathering. The funds will ensure the building remains safe and comfortable for the children and families who rely on the hospice's care. Jules Foster from Helen and Douglas House said, "We are so delighted with the response to our Fix the Roof appeal and to have raised £44,000 in just 2 weeks, which is phenomenal. We would like to thank the community of supporters who have come together to raise this amazing amount of money in such a short time. The hospice, which has welcomed thousands of families in its 43 years of operation, relies on public donations for 87% of its funding. The roof repairs will help to ensure the facilities remain fit for purpose for decades to come." Astrid Hales, head of building maintenance at Helen and Douglas House, said, "Four decades of weathering have taken their toll on the charity's buildings, and by acting now before the winter, when more damage could occur, we will prevent further problems in the months and years to come. Among the areas needing repair are the conservatory, which serves as a play area for children, and the sensory room. 10-year-old Edith Williams, who has a life-shortening condition called Alexander's disease and lives in Didcot, is one of the many children who benefit from the hospice's services. She began visiting Helen and Douglas House in August 2021. Edith's mum, Sarah Williams, said, "Helen and Douglas House, their support is invaluable to us. We get respite stays with them, which gives me a chance to sleep, and Edith can do arts and crafts, and the nurses take over her medical care. We have had many lovely times in the conservatory at the hospice, meeting animals like Harry the pony. Edith also loves playing in the sensory room too. Coming to stay at Helen and Douglas House gives me a chance to be mummy, rather than mummy, nurse and carer, and not having to wear all those different hats. When you walk into Helen and Douglas House, it is like being given a warm hug. They scoop you up, cook your dinner, and are there for you through the good times and bad, with lots of advice and holding your hand along the way. They are absolutely wonderful, and we would be lost without them and their support."
We are losing count of the number of photographs we have published of young people winning the Duke of Edinburgh Awards. Pictures of ceremonies at Buckingham Palace, Oxford Town Hall and other places keep coming to light, including one taken in 1968. The Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress of Oxford, Air Vice Marshal William McNeice Foster and his wife, invited a group of Gold Award winners to their Town Hall parlour. Earlier in the day, 30 girls had been presented with silver awards and 69 girls were given bronze awards by the Chief Constable of Oxford, Clement Burrows. An extra bonus awaited the gold winners. Not only were they the guests in the Lord Mayor's parlour, they were also to receive their awards from the Duke of Edinburgh at Buckingham Palace. An extra incentive, perhaps, as the Oxford Mail pointed out, for the silver and bronze winners to aim for the gold award. The day at the Town Hall was particularly special, as there were displays of country dancing, judo, fencing and public speaking, all activities connected with the scheme. The Girls' Award programme was in four sections: an occupation connected with themselves or their homes, a chosen hobby, an expedition and public service. At that time, more than 400 girls were taking part in activities under the scheme in Oxford, which was run by City Youth Officer Alison Lang. So who were the 14 gold winners on that occasion? We don't have their addresses, but we know their names: Elizabeth Allen, Mary Booker, Judith Carter, Susan Chandler, Patricia Downs, Malvina Millam, Frances Mumby, Kathleen Parsons, Charmaine Richards, Frances Schofield, Catherine Smith, Yvonne Stewart, Joy Tompkins, and Valerie Thompson.
Post office bosses should have known Horizon was faulty, but maintained the fiction that its data was always accurate when prosecuting sub-postmasters. The first tranche of a public inquiry's final report has concluded. Chairman Sir Wynne Williams said, "A number of senior people at the organisation were aware that the system, known as Legacy Horizon, was capable of error up until it was changed in 2010, with a number of employees also aware that the updated system, Horizon Online, also had bugs and defects. A total of 59 victims of the Horizon scandal contemplated suicide, with 10 attempting to take their own lives," Sir Wynne's report concluded. Sir Wynne said around 10,000 people are eligible to submit compensation claims following what has been dubbed the worst miscarriage of justice in British legal history. Lead campaigner and former sub-postmistress Jo Hamilton said, "The report shows the full scale of the horror that they unleashed on us." Ex-Post Office Chief Executive Paula Venables is accused of overseeing a huge number of wrongful prosecutions and convictions, and was in post at the time Sir Wynne said bosses should have known Horizon was faulty. Approximately 1,000 people were wrongly prosecuted and convicted throughout the UK between 1999 and 2015 as a result of faulty Fujitsu software, the report said. The publication of the first tranche of the report on July the 8th focused on the impact of the scandal on victims and the compensation offered, with a further report expected at a later date. Sir Wynne made 19 recommendations as part of his report, including that the government and the post office should make a public announcement about what they mean by, quote, full and fair redress. In a statement, the post office said, "We apologise unreservedly for the suffering which the post office caused to postmasters and their loved ones. We will carefully consider the report and its recommendations."
The Prime Minister and the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh were among those who gathered to mark the 20th anniversary of the July 7 London bombings at St Paul's Cathedral. Four coordinated attacks on three tube trains and a double-decker bus killed 52 people and left several hundred injured in the worst single terrorist atrocity on British soil. Sir Keir and the Royals were joined by the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, survivors, emergency responders and bereaved relatives at the commemorative ceremony. Earlier, the Prime Minister and Sir Sadiq laid wreaths at the July the 7th memorial in Hyde Park at 8:50 a.m. on Monday to coincide with the time that the first bomb went off. In a statement issued to mark the anniversary, Sir Keir said, "Today the whole country will unite to remember the lives lost in the 7/7 attacks. We honour the courage shown on that day, the bravery of the emergency services, the strength of survivors, and the unity of Londoners in the face of terror."
Shocking new figures released by the RSPCA show a 25% annual increase in animal cruelty reports in Oxfordshire. Figures show reports to the charity during the summer period rose from 185 in 2023 to 2,033 last year. The RSPCA dealt with a cruelty case in the county when 7 seriously ill kittens were dumped in a garden in Kiley in December. The 4-week-old kittens had cat flu and ringworm, and it was touch and go whether they would pull through. But all survived, thanks to the care of RSPCA Oxfordshire. The animal welfare charity has released the new statistics as part of its summer cruelty campaign. In June, July and August last year, across England and Wales, the RSPCA took 34,401 cruelty calls to their emergency line, compared to 25,887 the year before. RSPCA Chief Inspector Ian Briggs, an expert in cruelty cases, said, "We are seeing a shocking rise in the number of seasonal calls reporting animal cruelty to our emergency line. Sadly, the summer months tend to be when these reports peak. We don't know why for sure, why cruelty peaks at this time of year, but the surge in pet ownership during the pandemic has played a part."
A section of the A34 connecting Oxfordshire to the southern counties closed at the weekend. Drivers needed to make a huge 75-mile diversion following National Highway's closure between the Didcot Junction and Cheveley in West Berkshire. Northbound of the busy carriageway had been closed by the authority. Workmen were busy carrying out road surfacing throughout the weekend. The closure was in place from 9 p.m. on Friday to 9 a.m. on Monday. Meanwhile, the diversion route, which has been written to be suitable for lorries, takes drivers east from Junction 13 on the M4 to Junction 89, where they should turn north onto the A404. At the Handy Cross roundabout, they were advised to take the first exit onto the M40 northbound and continue on there until Junction 9, after which they can turn south to Oxford or continue their journey. On Google Maps, the journey distance is approximately 74.5 miles, and the travel time, not accounting for traffic, is around 1 hour and 20 minutes. National Highway said, "We've chosen weekend work as the least disruptive option overall." Drivers who cannot go on motorways, learners, moped and agricultural vehicles are advised to go the other direction using the A338 and the A417. There were shorter routes to take, although these won't be signposted.
Thames Valley Police is looking to crack down on crime and antisocial behaviour in town and city centres this summer. The force will increase police officers' presence and work with its partners to tackle urban crime as part of the National Safer Streets Summer Campaign, running from July through to September. Assistant Chief Constable Christian Bunt said, "This summer there will be an emphasis on effective local policing. That it is about more than just fighting crime. It is also about building relationships, police addressing local concerns, and being where it matters most. Historically, certain crime types such as, but not limited to, antisocial behaviour and retail crime rises in the summer months, especially in places that have town centres. Local policing teams will also carry out operations and days of action to address illegal e-scooter use, street crime, shoplifting, and other community concerns. Existing public spaces protection orders may see enhanced levels of enforcement." Thames Valley Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Barber said, "I support the work being done to increase the visibility of officers and tackle antisocial behaviour and retail crime in our streets, as these offences really matter. It's also encouraging to see partners signing up to make town centres safer in line with our plan to reclaim public spaces as we protect communities, people and property.
Jeremy Clarkson is set to make a huge change to his Cotswold pub in the near future. The TV star, known for presenting roles on BBC's Top Gear and Prime Video's The Grand Tour, ventured into farming after purchasing an Oxfordshire farm in 2008. Diddley Squat Farm in Chadlington has been the focus of all four series of the Prime Video documentary show Clarkson's Farm since it debuted in 2021. Mr. Clarkson recently added a pub to his business roster alongside the farm, purchasing the windmill in Astor near Burford for around £1 million. Renaming it the Farmer's Dog, the 65-year-old opened the Cotswolds Boozer to the public last August, with huge crowds turning out for the occasion. One decision from the outset which captured attention was Mr. Clarkson's decision to serve British-only produce with regard to the food and drink at the watering hole. This meant there would be no cola to drink nor ketchup to eat, setting the pub out on its own in a unique way, reflecting British farmers' interests. A sign near the pub's entrance read, "Everything we cook, serve and sell is grown or raised or produced in Great Britain, even the salt and pepper. This means we don't serve Coca-Cola or ketchup. # Back British Farming." Yet the bold choice not to serve ketchup could be changing after almost a year without the popular condiment at the Farmer's Dog. Condi Maniac, a British sauce company, have created a completely British ketchup, taking on Clarkson's challenge. Co-founders Keir Kemp and Jennifer Dreyer have masterminded a homegrown product which is entirely British. Having been inspired by the sign at the pub, Condi Maniac delivered a batch of the sauce to the Farmer's Dog. Shown in a video on the brand's Instagram page, customers at the pub tried the ketchup and remarked how amazing it tasted. "I'm not having Heinz again, that is for sure," one said. A staff member at the Farmer's Puppy, which is located on the grounds of the pub by the Grand Tour tent, also gave credit for the sauce. Condi Maniac's meeting with manager Annie went well too, as she agreed to sell the ketchup at wholesale on their on-site butchers, as well as at the Farmer's Puppy. Mr. Kemp said, "It's not just a gimmick for them. They really do live and breathe this 100% British thing. They're the best wholesale clients I've ever dealt with. Everyone I've met is super lovely. I'm glad that I can report they are actually nice people. It's not always like that." The 100% British ketchup is available to buy via the official Condi Maniac website, but it is currently sold out. The first thing that struck me after landing in Jakarta was the humidity. Soon after was the warmness and willingness to help by people. More on that later. My trip to Indonesia started at Heathrow in the early hours of Friday morning, and after changing flights in Doha, I finally arrived in Jakarta at 7:30 in the morning, local time, on Saturday, 1:30 a.m. in the UK. Inevitably, there was a fair whack of jet lag and tiredness stepping off the plane, and I was sharply brought to life when the humidity hit me leaving the airport. We'd heard that word, humidity, so much in the lead-up to the trip. How would the Oxford United players and staff cope with it? Would the training times have to change? And what would it be like for the games? Well, I can tell you, it's like nothing I've ever experienced before. The only comparable thing would be if you'd been to an insect or reptile house. Now imagine that doubled and everywhere you go, from first thing in the morning right through till the evening when the air begins to clear a bit. From leaving the airport, though, it was over to the hotel, a quick check-in and breakfast, and pretty much straight over to the Gelora Bungkarno main stadium, where Gary Rowett and Ole Romney were in the process of a pre-match press conference with the waiting media. We got a sneak preview of inside the ground, and having been mightily impressed by the exterior, wow, it was something else in the bowels of the stadium. With a capacity of 78,000, it would rank among one of the bigger grounds in the UK. It looks to be a fantastic arena to play football, and the running track out around the perimeter of the pitch adds a classy European feel. Then it was time to collect the accreditation pass alongside the hundreds of Indonesian press and the story of humility rather than humidity. Working at the same table as BBC Radio Oxford's Jerome Sale, I went to charge my laptop when, with an almighty crash, the collapsible structure of the foldaway table gave way, sending water bottles, phones and other tech kit flying. In the half second it took me to realise what had happened, half a dozen of our Indonesian media colleagues had already rushed over to help us, holding up the table, picking up our equipment off the floor. The desire to help was remarkable, and that warm welcome has been extended everywhere we've gone. Now, deep into the afternoon, after catching up with some work, it was time to get some kip. After a long and exhausting 24 hours that was then topped up by a rapid-fire first day in Jakarta, I needed a good snooze ahead of United's first game here. As far as first impressions go, it's been a fabulous start, filled with humidity and humility.
The government's proposals, which suggest council should raise council tax by 5% every year, will create a significant burden for taxpayers, the County Council's finance chief has said. Documents in the government's spending review from last month show that they expect councils to increase council tax by the maximum amount every year until the end of the parliamentary term in 2029. The government also unveiled plans at the end of last month to direct more government funding to councils in more deprived areas as part of changes to funding rules. The Cabinet Member for Finance, Dan Levy, said this could mean less money for Oxfordshire. In a written question ahead of this week's full council meeting, fellow Lib Dem councillor Nathan Lee asked Cabinet Member for Finance Dan Levy what the implications of the government's plans were for residents living in Oxfordshire. In his written response, Mr. Levy said, "It is very concerning to see the expectation that the bulk of increases in funding to pay for local services will be funded through council tax rather than through government funding. The expectation that council tax will increase by 5% every year for the next 3 years is a significant burden on taxpayers and removes autonomy from councils. This approach places an undue strain on residents who are already facing financial challenges. Council tax is by no means the fairest tax and has little relationship to ability to pay. We will continue to provide services to residents who need them, while continually looking for efficiencies in how the council operates, but expect significant pressure on our budgets." He added that he appreciated the government's efforts to provide additional funding to local government, but that other decisions made by the government, including increasing employers' national insurance, have increased the costs for council. Oxfordshire County Council increased council tax by 4.99% in its February budget. In the full council meeting, Mr. Levy said it was fairly likely that there would be a rebalance in government funding towards metropolitan councils rather than rural ones, while the details had not yet been confirmed. He added, "Inevitably, that means Oxfordshire will have less money. We will manage the situation effectively, but it's not a good place to be in. Councils have the power to increase council tax by a maximum of 5% each year. Councils can only increase council tax by more than this if they hold a referendum or get approval from central government."
Travel groups have rallied behind a letter supporting brave plans for an Oxford congestion charge and say all modes of transport will benefit from the scheme. Under the temporary plans, motorists would face a £5 daily charge for driving their cars through several city roads without a permit. The measure is being considered by Oxfordshire County Council to help ease congestion in the short term due to the delayed traffic filter trial. It has caused some controversy, with a petition against the creation of the congestion charge gaining 10,700 signatures. The letter urges the County Council to implement the temporary congestion charge for cars to unblock our city and for more road space to be created to encourage a multimodal future for the city's roads. Oxford Bus Company, Stagecoach West, City of Oxford Licensed Taxi Cab Association, Cyclox and COSAT have signed the letter. Chris Hansen, Managing Director of Stagecoach West, said, "The proposal of a congestion charge can benefit all of these modes of transport. The only mode that doesn't is the use of a private car. I think that's a really strong message, that actually this is for the benefit of everyone in the long term. While there are peaks and troughs, there's a general slowing of our journeys as a result of that congestion that spreads all year round." He added that taking away low traffic neighbourhoods, which some opponents have suggested, would not solve the problem. When asked about whether the rise in bus fares made paying the congestion charge more appealing, he said the costs of parking, petrol and EV charges still make bus travel much better value than travelling by car. He added that the bus companies would push the County Council to use the revenue created from the congestion charge, which is ring-fenced for travel improvements, to make park and ride fares and bus fares cheaper. Ian Loder, chair of Cyclox, said, "We've come to the conclusion that the status quo for Oxford traffic really isn't working. If no one does anything, the city will grind to a halt. There's a series of really dangerous junctions for cyclists in Oxford, and you can't do anything to make them safer unless you reduce car traffic. If you plan a city for cars, everybody loses. Bus passengers lose, cyclists lose, pedestrians lose and drivers lose. If you plan a city to maximise the choice for means and modes of transport, everybody wins, including drivers."
Almost 2,000 people have signed a petition opposing County Council plans to switch off almost 60,000 streetlights. Oxfordshire County Council has proposed turning off the majority of its lights overnight across the county, which it says would save £400,000 a year. But the Liberal Democrat-run council has faced resistance from residents, the Police and Crime Commissioner Matthew Barber, and MP Annalisa Dodds. A petition against the plan received 1,940 by the weekend. Oxfordshire County Council's consultation, which ended at the start of the week, said, "Park night lighting is an approach to reducing or switching off street lighting in an area for part of the night. It is intended to be used during the hours when the fewest people are using the streets. Park night lighting isn't new. It operates in many other parts of the UK and is already allowed for in our current street lighting and illuminated assets policy. We are proposing to introduce park night lighting to improve the nighttime environment for residents and wildlife, as well as energy and carbon reduction." Andrew Gant, Oxfordshire County Council's Cabinet Member for Transport Management, defended the proposal and said there is no intention to reduce street lighting where there are concerns about its impact. He said, "We want to hear people's views and concerns, especially to help us understand potential impacts on those who are perceived as being at risk from crime or harm. The aim of the policy is to improve the natural environment from a carbon and biodiversity perspective, while keeping personal and community safety as a priority consideration. we recognise that one size does not fit all. Different operating hours, levels of light intensity and exemptions will form part of our proposals to meet different communities' needs. We want part-night lighting to be a community choice, which is why the public's feedback is crucial in helping us to get this right. Residents could have their say on the proposals by visiting the County Council's website. Meanwhile, once the consultation closes and the results have been read through, Cabinet will discuss the findings at a meeting expected in September. Then a decision could be made.
Hundreds of people celebrated a Witney Swimming Club's 50th anniversary. More than 260 people attended an event at Cokethorpe School in Witney, celebrating 5 decades of Witney and District Swimming Club. They were joined by more than 30 volunteers and performers at the event, which was opened by the Mayor of Wantage, Andy Bailey, and was attended by swimmers, families and volunteers from across the club's history. The event had a festival-like atmosphere, featuring performers throughout the afternoon and evening, outdoor games, cocktail-making sessions, a cabaret, a magician, musical bingo, and performances by local artists. There was also a cake provided by the cake shop. Musicians from an Oxford orchestra recently visited a hospice charity to deliver interactive performances to the patients. Oxford Philharmonic Orchestra visited Sobel House Hospice and 3 wards at the Fulbrook Centre and the Churchill Hospital. Led by solo flute Tony Robb, the musicians performed well-known pieces with the opportunity to sing and play along on percussion instruments. The musicians have been performing at the Churchill Hospital for more than 20 years, with 13 performances during the 2024-25 season. Led by sub-principal violin Miranda Walton, musicians from OPO delivered workshops with the theme Circus to 60 students at Pegasus Primary School in Blackpool Leas. These workshops included interactive performances, instrument demonstrations, musical games and composition activities. The 3-day project culminated in a performance for family and friends.
James Bond star Dame Judi Dench has backed a campaign to save the ghost woods in Oxfordshire. The 90-year-old actress from York rose to international fame as M in 1995's GoldenEye in the spy film saga. She went on to play the role in a total of 8 James Bond films, leading up to one last cameo appearance in 2015's Spectre. Dame Judi has now backed a new cause as campaigners in Oxfordshire came together to call for England's ancient forests to be restored. The event, organised by Right to Roam Oxfordshire, took place in Burnwood Forest near Bicester. Contained within is one of the nation's ghost woods, an ancient woodland site felled and replaced by a timber plantation. The gathering was part of a series of actions taking place across the country, aimed at driving Forestry England to fulfil its commitment to restore this vital habitat. Dame Judi has had her say in the event and backed the notion to protect the ghost woods on the Oxfordshire border. Forestry England is responsible for over 100,000 acres that were once ancient, life-filled woodland, she said. These were places of deep memory and wild beauty, but instead of letting nature return, much of the land has been smothered with fast-growing timber plantations. These places are now often uniform, silent, and sterile. In the process, we've lost so much of the rich biodiversity that once thrived there. I've always felt there is profound wisdom in trees, an ancient wisdom that we need to retain and let speak again. That's why this matters so much to me. Thankfully, beneath these silent ghost woods, the heartbeat of life is still beating. Fragile threads of fungal networks and native seed banks are still clinging on. But scientists are warning us that they won't last much longer. If we don't act soon, they'll be lost forever. It's time to let these forests live and breathe once more. Today's event supports a national campaign by the grassroots campaign group Wildcard, which has been backed by Oscar-winning actress and nature lover Dame Judi Dench. During today's event, attendees took part in a ghost hunt, searching for fragments of native forest, smothered beneath the monoculture plantation. Poppy, a local attending the event, said, "There are patches of stunning native woodlands within Burnwood Forest, as well as the beautiful butterfly walk, which was buzzing with wildflowers and insects. Imagine how amazing the forest could be if it all looked like that. We want to see the conifer plantations restored back to native woodland so that nature can thrive." In 2022, DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, set a new national target to restore or start the restoration of the majority of ancient woodlands covered with plantations by 2030, following a missed initial target of 2020.
A Riverside museum has announced its closing date after recent net losses have reached £1 million a year. The Henley River and Rowing Museum will close to the public on Sunday, September 21st, after a long-running struggle to achieve financial stability. In a public statement, the museum said an endowment was depleted by essential building works and significant increases in the cost of operation, leading to recent net losses averaging £1 million a year. It added that trustees have taken the extremely difficult decision to shut down the museum while there are still sufficient funds to undertake the closure and find new homes for its extensive collections. All the staff of the museum will be leaving shortly after the closure date, and the remaining time will be spent rehoming the four core collections, which number 35,000 objects. Chairman of Trustees David Worthington said, "The quality of the original concept cannot be underestimated. However, ultimately the venture was just too ambitious. Six galleries, multiple public spaces, two classrooms, a 5,000 square foot storage facility and a 35,000 object collection. It was just too much. I want to give thanks and pay tribute to the thousands of hours of commitment, heavy lifting and simple belief that have come from the leadership, employees and the volunteers, from patrons, members, sponsors, trustees and more. Everyone has tried to make it work, and on one level we have. It has been a great museum, lauded when opened, enjoyed by well over 2 million people, remembered by second and third generations and over 100,000 school children. But in the end, however exciting it might have been, whatever changes might have been made, the financial challenge was simply too great." Henley River and Rowing Museum in Mill Meadows has occupied a huge, stunning complex of buildings covering nearly an acre on the riverside since it opened in 1998. The trustees added that a key factor behind the failure of the museum's financial sustainability was the scale of the building and the cost to maintain it, which is way beyond that of a specialist museum in a small market town. Because of this ongoing constriction, a new museum is not expected to take over the building in its entirety, as it would not be able to support itself. However, looking for a new use of space is an urgent concern of the museum's foundation. A suggestion has also been brought forward that a new but much smaller Henley Museum could be created from leftover fund from the River and Rowing Museum. The final opening weekend of the popular Riverside Museum coincides with Henley's Heritage Open Days Festival, with free admission for guests.
And that is all the news for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about Ox Talk, please feel free to contact us by phoning 07496 062 280. That is 07496 062 280. Please remember to leave your name and contact number with your message, or you can send us an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and past editions are available on our website, www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can listen to these editions directly or download them online. If you need any help or have any further queries, please feel free to contact us. That is all for now. We hope you have a wonderful week, and thank you for listening.